Welcome to the Earth Keepers Podcast. This podcast is for people who seek new and better ways to love and care for the Earth. It's a podcast for anyone who is deeply concerned about the harm being done to the environment on a local and global level. It's a podcast that builds community and connection between people of like heart and mind, people who believe that Earth care should be integrated into every aspect of life. And for many in the Earth Keepers community, that includes our spiritual practices. My name is Forrest Dinsley, and today I'll be talking with Christy Renone, Director of Marketing and Development for an organization called Plant with Purpose. Plant with Purpose works with impoverished communities around the world, helping people to build strong local economies by encouraging good agriculture and financial management practices. What sets Plant with Purpose apart from many other international development agencies, though, is their emphasis on ecology and environmental health. In essence, they help farmers to become better earth keepers. Importantly, Plant with Purpose doesn't teach earth keeping in a way that dismisses or dishonors what farmers already know. Instead, they work alongside them in partnership, offering ideas and resources, but also asking questions that respect local knowledge. You see, Plant with Purpose operates on the assumption that farmers know their own environmental context better than any outsiders ever can.
It's not our place to say this is what you should do because it's better. We're just trying to help you figure out how to do what you do to the best of your abilities. And we recognize and honor that you have much more knowledge about your local context than we do.
Welcome, friends, to the Earth Keepers Podcast. Welcome, Christy. I'm so glad you could take time with us. I've been eager to talk to you because as a professor of community development, I've always been impressed with Plant with Purpose because as an organization, you do things so differently. And I think you're really, in some ways, modeling some values that a lot of nonprofits, which are more centered on human need alone, I think you're modeling something that more people can embrace as a practice in terms of development. But instead of stealing your thunder, let me ask you to tell me a bit about Plant with Purpose and what the organization does.
So Plant with Purpose, we work at the intersection of rural poverty and environmental degradation. We were started about 35 years ago in the Dominican Republic, but we've expanded globally. We have a large program presence in Africa, still Latin America, and a little bit of Asia. Essentially, what we see is that most of the people, about 75 to 80% of people who are living below the poverty line around the world, are rural, rely on the land for the main source of their living, may have some side businesses, a side hustle that they do, but farming is where they get their food and their income. And a lot of times, the most vulnerable of those people groups are farming land that nobody else wants. It could be steep hillsides, it could be floodplains, land that just is not producing and therefore is available for the poorest of the poor. And that's where we step in. We've spent many years learning, experimenting, innovating, trying, failing, trying again, until we've come up with this suite of program solutions that we do in partnership with local communities that help to heal the land, reverse that environmental degradation, turn it into a cycle where it gets better year after year after year using locally available resources, a lot of organic farming methods. Reforestation is huge. Trying to figure out how do we restore these watersheds where we work to the point where they're continuously providing more and more and more for these families. And then at the same time, we step in and help families get on a firm financial footing. And we do all of this within the framework of Christian faith. Short answer, we work at the intersection of environmental degradation, poverty, and spiritual renewal.
And I'm wondering, how much do you actually rely on the people that you're helping to help you understand the job that you're doing? Because obviously, to do environmental restoration, you need to understand the environment at a pretty intimate level. And that's not knowledge that is textbook knowledge. It really does, it seems to me, depend on the people who live in the place. So how would you describe that interaction, I guess, between folks from the West, perhaps, who want to be useful and offer resources, and the people on the ground who are actually living in place and know the place well?
So this is where Plant with Purpose is quite dramatically different from a lot of other nonprofits. We have no expat staff, meaning we have no foreigners working in the countries where we work. All of our staff on the ground are local. We have found that a lot of our directors even come from the communities where we work, or their family is in that location. We try our best to make sure that we're identifying those local leaders who are able to lead our programs. In addition to that, any staff that we do have, for the most part, is our kind of lower level facilitators, village agents. We have a whole bunch of names for them, but people who live and work in those communities and have been there for generations, who are able to connect us to their neighbors. And that's really where I say this sometimes, that we're experts at grassroots mobilization. When we talk with other environmental organizations, we've realized that our asset is that we're just really good at getting a community to change the way that they think and they act and they work. And it's because we don't come in with an outside-in approach. We just meet people where they are. So there's that piece. On top of that, we do also have a lot of our national staff who have been trained in agriculture and forestry and economic developments and spiritual renewal. So it's not like we don't have experts. We have strong experts, but they're rooted in those communities, and they have that mix of understanding the local environment and the knowledge sharing. And then over the years, we've found that there's just a few things that work globally, and sometimes they've taken us by surprise. And so the way that we're structured, we're a family of organizations, and all of our partners are local organizations who have the ability to do what they need to do, but exist within the Plant with Purpose family and kind of feed knowledge up to us as well as learn what works. So there's a few times where we've said, hey, this technique that we're trying in this country, everybody should do this. And we've had those directors say, no way, it won't work here. And that's allowed us to say, well, maybe we should check. Maybe we should try and see. And it's been a really fun experience, because I think it's harder than just a top-down organization that says, hey, this is what works, do it. It's harder because you have to constantly sell your team on why you're doing what you do. But I think it's better, because through that process, you figure out what really is core and important, and what maybe isn't going to work in this cultural context, but will work there.
Absolutely. You make me curious to know what those two extremes look like. On the one hand, a contextualized approach that really is about a certain place and a certain time among certain people, versus something that has surprised you, that you've learned that could be applicable in a broader context. I mean, what would be two examples of that?
The example of the thing that surprised us is when we started, we were much more of like a traditional microfinance organization, in that we had a loan-based program where we provided loans to community members to invest in forestry businesses, timber businesses, things that we thought were complementary to the work that we were doing, or just whatever it was that people wanted a loan for. And it didn't work very well. Loan products in an environment where you're growing a large crop that might take many months to provide, plus everybody's really spread out, it's just really hard to pull those off without charging really high interest rates. And so it was one of those things that we thought, okay, this is kind of helpful, but we don't really think we're excelling at it. And I was probably about 2005, we piloted the Village Savings and Loan methodology, which is, instead of providing capital that's used in those financial tools, the communities themselves save a little bit every week. And then that's the pool of money from which people are able to take loans to invest in building their businesses. In almost every country where we tried to roll that system out, first of all, we saw that it was substantially more effective. And the data shows it. It's become the norm in a lot of community development to use a savings-led financial approach. But at that point in time, it still felt new and fresh and unusual. So in almost every country that we said, hey, this works better than this, you really should try this, what I heard on the ground was people saying, you know, I am too poor to save. I can't save. You need to give me money so that I can build a business so that I can save. what we said is, well, actually, I think that you're too poor not to save. You really need to be saving. And we're just seeing through all of the research and all of the data that this system works better. It helps you get on your feet with a firm financial foundation on which you can build your business. And you're not indebted to us. You could do whatever you want with it. The most striking example that I remember was a community in Burundi, which Burundi's in Central Africa, just south of Rwanda. It's one of the most food insecure countries. Every year it rates in the top 5 or top 10 most insecure food countries. So people don't have enough food to eat, often hungry, often trying to figure out how to just meet their daily needs. So objectively, I would say of all people, they are the ones who could tell me with confidence, I am too poor to save. And I sat there in that community listening to our staff who were giving the speaking points that I had kind of coached them to try, which are, you're too poor not to save. It just was one of those moments where I thought, oh, what are we doing? this is ridiculous. But then a couple months later, there was just some environmental challenges that happen all the time. What happened was we were talking to some communities in the highlands and some communities in the lowlands within one watershed. And there was a drought in the highland area that led to some erosion, which then when the rains did come, caused mass flooding in the lowlands. So both of the people in the high areas and the low areas lost their crops and had to replant. And it was devastating. They lost everything. I then thought, okay, they're never going to try this savings model. We're lost. Never going to work here. This is it. That was one straw too many, just bad timing. But what happened was they came back to us and said, you know, we've been thinking about what you were saying. And if we had been saving, we would be able to replant by tapping into our savings. Right now, we've got nothing. And we're needing to choose things like selling a goat or a cow that provides protein and a source of income. Or we're needing to take our kids out of school or maybe not access healthcare, or the choices they were facing were so bad that they were thinking, I wish I had saved. That was how our savings program started in Burundi.
It's interesting that they actually decided that was the lesson to be derived, right? I mean, they had been presented with this alternative, but it was a choice. And I think it was through their experience that they determined the potential value of that choice. And then were able, I assume, then to make that choice for themselves. Yeah.
Yeah. So they said, okay, we'll give it a shot. And from there, we went from a pilot project to rolling it out across the country really rapidly, because as their neighbors watched, their neighbors thought, oh yeah, I want to try that. Mostly how it happened was at the end of a year of savings, usually the first few families who try it might do something like throw a big party. And we encourage that. I mean, we don't encourage that. Use it in the best way you possibly can, but it's your money. Do whatever you want with it. And then they come back and say, whoa, I wasted a lot of money on that. What if I had bought an asset or spent more money on seeds or bought a goat or built an extension on my kitchen so that I could have a safer place to cook or something like that? But it's through those experiences and everybody watching them that the rest of the community decides, I want this. And usually the first year is kind of low. And then the second year, people really jump in full speed and invest heavily in the program. So that was one that we started first in Tanzania and then rolled out globally within a few years and is now the platform of everything we do across all of our country programs.
It sounds like trust and humility are really important values in the work that you do, in the sense that you allow people to learn, you encourage them to learn, you encourage them to use their own volition to determine their futures, which I love. And I'm wondering, what would be an example of something that somewhere you were taught out of the context that was context specific, something that maybe Plant with Purpose would never have imagined as a possible solution or a possible way forward to the challenges that they faced?
I mean, the savings group would probably be our most classic example of that, in that we didn't come up with it. I think the first people were, I think it was CARE that first developed and piloted that system, but it was based on a local knowledge way of handling finance. So that would be something that came out of some community, spread through the NGO world, came to us. And I think that there's a lot of that within the industry. I would say that some of our innovations are things that we came up with, but probably most of our innovations are just through that process of listening and creating mechanisms for local innovation. So with our agriculture program, we have what we call environment core curriculum, which is we know that these few techniques are really helpful around the world, and we want to see communities do a mix of some core things that everybody should be doing. Thinking about agroforestry as a method is pretty much always applicable in the places where we work, especially. But in some places, you may have a semi-arid climate, and other places, you're tropical. So the way that you would adapt the actual techniques that you're teaching communities would be dramatically different. There's also cultural things that we're learning and responding to and listening to. A lot of our systems allow our local country teams to pick and choose which of these make sense in this place, but we also do a lot of our training through different participatory ways of talking to communities. So farmer field schools is one classic example where instead of just saying to farmers, you should do this biointensive style of garden, we say, you know, there's this type of gardening that uses a lot of mulch and compost and just ways of structuring your garden that uses less water. It doesn't require you to have fertilizer. We can also teach you some ways to use local available plants and resources instead of a pesticide. And it's really effective and it's free because everything is local. So your profits are higher. If we just said it like that, what we found is most people say, you don't know what you're talking about. you guys are an NGO. You don't really know what it's like to be a farmer. It's one thing to say that to our staff. A lot of our staff really are farmers. And so it's a little bit easier for them to pass that along. But the biggest way that we see adoption of the technologies is by saying, hey, there's this idea. Try it. Test it. Why don't you build two gardens, maybe as a community? Try this method and try that method. And then just write your observations and wait 8 weeks, maybe grow spinach or something that's easy and fast. And yeah, just see what happens and write it down and come back and tell me what you learned. We find that through that method, often they come up with new ways of doing that biointensive garden that we hadn't thought of, that we can then take to other communities and say, hey, here's this really cool idea, but is also substantially more effective for having them not just learn what we've taught, but apply it in their farms and then spread it to their neighbors. And so it's that adoption rate. And I think it's largely just because it's not our place to say this is what you should do because it's better. We're just trying to help you figure out how to do what you do to the best of your abilities. And we recognize and honor that you have much more knowledge about your local context than we do.
Absolutely. And of course, whatever they end up doing, they're going to be owning that and investing themselves in it in a way that they might not if it had been some sort of imported strategy or technique that had just been handed down. So I like that very much. The trust factor is clearly so important.
It's what makes it work. And that's why we are good at grassroots mobilization, is we have the flexibility to allow that trust to develop.
In a way, you're experts at drawing out other people's expertise.
Yeah, that might be a better way to say it.
An important part of the Earthkeeper's mission is to expose the connections between environmental injustice and social injustice. For example, with the recent protests in the U.S. stemming from racial injustice, more people are becoming aware of the fact that environmental problems are inseparable from economic and racial inequality. The NAACP states, environmental injustice has a disproportionate impact on communities of color and low-income communities in the U.S. and around the world. Plant with Purpose does its work with a keen awareness that environmental justice cannot be separated from social justice. In fact, in many places, they have seen that when communities become reconciled to their ecologies, reconciliation between people becomes more possible as well. In other words, making peace with the land leads to peace between people. Well, I'm wondering if you could give us a sense of the work that Plant with Purpose does more from a narrative perspective. I mean, you probably know stories of villages or families which would kind of exemplify the work that you do and maybe the deepest values of Plant with Purpose. Could you tell us a story of folks that you know?
My husband is a videographer, so occasionally I can twist his arm and have him go help me collect a story. A couple of years ago, we got to go to this community in the Democratic Republic of the Congo in South Kivu, which is where we're working. It's a beautiful area, right on some steep hillsides that are in between a large national forest area where there's still some gorillas. There's still really old growth forest. It's one of the three largest rainforests in the world. And then there's these steep slopes that are farmed leading down to Lake Tanganyika, the base of that. So it's an area that's pretty vulnerable as families are needing to figure out how to continue to feed themselves and grow more food. They're often going into that forest area. And so the forest is at risk. And a lot of the animals that are up in that forest that are highly vulnerable are at risk. So that's why we chose to work in that area. It's also an area that's completely isolated from a lot of the world and very poor. We met a couple. Their names are Monica and Kamno, and they've got 8 kids, and they live in a little round hut made out of mud and a thatched roof. Very simple, stunningly beautiful. They farmed those steep slopes. It took us probably 7 or 8 hours to hike to where they live. We were carrying lots of heavy camera equipment and were a lot more out of shape than the local people are. I think they could probably do it in 2 hours, but sure. There's no road is what I'm trying to say. And it's very rough terrain. It's also an area that has had a lot of conflict over the past years. There's often fighting among different people groups and a lot of history of conflict in that region. So it's not always been safe for the communities to mix. So the people who live on those slopes and the people who live in the islands and the people who live down by the lake are often at war with each other, which means that those communities are just super isolated and rely on themselves and their land. So in meeting this family, we had come in our program at a point where there was tentative peace. And we thought if we come in now, we might be able to move this community towards a spot of more permanent peace. But that was just a hoped for outcome. We weren't really sure what was going to happen. We thought maybe we'll come in and the conflict will rise up again and we'll have to leave. But luckily, that wasn't the case. So we worked with Monica and Kamno's family for about 2.5, maybe 3 years before I met them. So they were still pretty early in the project. We often see that for the full environmental change to happen, it takes more like 7 to 10 years. But in Congo, since there was that moment of peace and there was such hunger for a way to improve their livelihood, we saw just rapid adoption in those communities, and it was fantastic. So Monica and Kamno's family, I'm not entirely sure, but of the people in their community, they were eating 1 meal a day on average. Sometimes they'd get 2 meals a day. And after 2.5 years of working with us, we saw that they were eating 2 to 3 meals every day. So they had dramatically increased what they were able to grow. They also were starting to build some market connections with people who lived in the lowland areas. And so Monica had started a business where she would walk the several hours down the mountain to the lake, buy little anchovies, essentially, these little teeny tiny small fish, cart them on her back or on her head in a basket, carry them all the way up the mountain and sell them for a profit to her neighbors who didn't feel like making that walk all the way down to the bottom and had a little extra cash because they were also growing more food than they were before. So it was just really cool to see their ingenuity and also to see that they were able to send some of their kids to school and start working towards figuring out how to better the life of their children. Also really exciting to see the ability to feed their children much stronger, healthier, more diverse diets. They were still working when we were there on figuring out how to improve their land. So their big challenge, because they were the people farming the slopes, was erosion and loss of their topsoil. So they had started with building a lot of contours on their land and thinking about how do they intermix different crops that stop that spread of erosion. They also were starting to plant a lot of trees and thinking about How do they start to reforest those slopes in a way that's complementary to the farming that they were trying to do? And so those were still really young and really small. I want to go back. I don't know if I'm going to be able to go back right now, but I'd love to go back in a few years and see as those trees grew up, how their community is changing. Very deforested area.
All these changes you're talking about, like the planting of trees or even the terracing. I mean, this is what Plant with Purpose does. I mean, these are the things that they help people to learn, or in some cases, I would imagine, to relearn from maybe traditional practices. And so to see that in action and to see it enacting systemic change, I mean, from the sound of it, there was an economy effect as well. If you're talking about people with more purchasing power, people starting small businesses, I mean, that's really amazing kind of change that results just from planting.
The most exciting change, though, was the peace aspect. We know that if you apply these techniques, you will preserve that topsoil. You'll be able to increase the fertility of that topsoil. You'll be able to grow more food. We also know that if you do savings groups, that you can get on that firm financial stand where you're able to start investing in something like starting a small business. So we know that those things work always. What we were unsure of is what's going to happen in this post-conflict area that is still so tentative. And what we found is that the communities, they were just eager for change and they were eager for growth and the ability to see that change and that growth, probably especially the food security aspect of it, that they weren't struggling. They were getting enough. There was still opportunity for further growth, and they saw that vision. I think they caught the vision of what the world could look like. What we saw in those communities is that a lot of the pastors and the elders were stepping up and actually preventing the younger boys or whoever it was from being sucked away into the life of a soldier, and that they were actually stopping some of the people who were likely to cause trouble from coming back into the communities until they agreed on living in a peaceful way in community. So what we've seen is that the watersheds where we're working, they haven't had those conflict areas rising back up. And we're planning a rapid expansion. We've been talking with some possible funders about dramatically scaling up our program to include a much larger area of land there, with the hope that we could eventually have a permanent change in the South Kivu region. I think we could if we just took that small project to scale.
There's something really beautiful about the thought of planting plants that lead to peace. I mean, it's just, you wouldn't normally pair those things together, but that's what you're talking about. You're talking about ecological restoration and care for the land that ultimately yields this enormous systemic social benefit.
It's hope.
It is hope. So I want to follow up on the comment you made. I want to go back. And I'm curious about why you want to go back. And maybe more importantly, what happens to you when you go and you see these things, when you meet these folks and understand what it is they're actually accomplishing in the face of pretty enormous odds sometimes?
I spent a lot of time living in a lot of areas around the world where poverty is extreme. And I've met a lot of people along the way who had these big dreams and maybe a little bit of a savior complex that I, as an American, can go solve these problems. I think that our culture loves to instill that in us. That I've watched a lot of my friends in this industry go live in places like India was my first extreme. And I lived in Calcutta for a while, and I think that was my first moment of like, whoa, everything I think I know is not true. And Africa was somewhere I went a little bit later, but it completely changes my priorities and the way that I see the world and what is important to me. I think the main reason I want to go back is I've built a relationship with these people, and I have a lot of friends in that region and just a lot of people that have meant a lot in my life. I would love to be able to go see them again, but I would just love the opportunity to keep developing those strong relationships and see what happens.
And that seems to me to be a particularly important word, relationship, because I think what happens, at least what I've observed, is that for those folks who want to help and yet don't take the time or the risk to form authentic relationship, they may tend toward shallower responses, like the response of pity or even romanticizing the poor. And I think in some ways, those can be dehumanizing responses. It doesn't allow people to be people versus relationship, where you actually know them for who they authentically are. But I think also real relationship takes the risk of being transformed in turn by the relationship with them, that you allow them to teach you and change you, even as you might hope to help them.
I studied management. That's where my expertise lies. And one of the things that I saw in all of my management courses is just this big push towards diversity. We are stronger when we're diverse. And if you've got one small group of people who all are very, very similar, they're going to come up with results that are small. If you can figure out how to work through cross-cultural management and how to work with a global multinational group of people, you're going to come up with a product that works better in a lot of different contexts and is probably substantially more innovative. And there's a lot of science behind that. And I think that that's part of what we're seeing in the way that we do development work and in the way that we are building these relationships around the world. It does allow for a different type of innovation to happen. I have really loved the opportunity to work really closely with people in East African context and in a few other places where I've lived. And I've found that it changes the way that I think. I think that God has created a really diverse and beautiful world. And the ability to go speak to a colleague and a friend who live just a radically different life than I do is a way to understand God a little bit better.
Of course, this podcast is an extension of a broader community called Circlewood. And one of our key questions is, how can we always become better earth keepers? How can we find new ways to protect and to restore and to even relate to creation? And we have come to believe that we desperately need new perspective on that. The limited perspectives that we have are incomplete. And so we're always after this diversity that you're talking about, that we know that we cannot know from a single monoculture perspective, that we need the diversity of perspective and the local wisdom, local knowledge, the historical learnings of different peoples all over the world. We need them desperately in order to find a way forward. So we are better together, I think, to echo the sentiment that you're expressing. Where did the environmental interest come from?
I think I always had an environmental interest. I was always a very outdoorsy adventure person, but honestly, it was pragmatic. When I look at the people at Plant with Purpose, there's a lot of people who came to Plant with Purpose because they love the environment component, but my journey was very pragmatic. When I was with that Earth Institute UNDP project, what I saw was we were really heavily relying on supply chains to get fertilizers, pesticides, fancy seeds to the communities, and they were not going to work. Like the supply chain was breaking down in every perspective. And so what I realized is organic and sustainable styles of teaching people how to farm their land, the kind of the old way of doing it, was substantially more profitable because you didn't have to pay for all these inputs, but it also was the only viable solution that seemed to present itself unless you had the infrastructure to get this product to the field. And the infrastructure just wasn't there. And it wasn't there for the poorest of the poor, especially. So that was kind of how I came at it. And then once I started to understand how things worked, really developed that passion for thinking about the environment as a way of helping families and for its own sake.
Do you find that your work has actually transformed your relationship to creation as you've learned these things and understood the values behind the work that Plant with Purpose does?
I think I've spent a lot of time thinking, especially over the last couple months as we've been working from home. Yeah, what does it look like to live sustainably? And how do we think about that as an extension of our faith? I think that there's some moral aspect there. Should I really be driving a SUV all the way across town every day? Or should I be thinking about a life that values others by living in a more sustainable fashion? So those are really hard questions.
They are. But I do find that there is some hope in the midst of this COVID crisis that maybe we'll be able to see some new possibilities, especially as we're forced to actually practice new possibilities. For example, I've had conference meetings with folks that normally I would be meeting with in other cities in different parts of the world. But because of travel restrictions, I've not been able to do that. But it's forced us to understand what is actually possible without the travel. So I'm looking forward to seeing where this all leads to, you know, and my hope is that there will be some lasting impacts that will get some vision for different ways of, as you put it, sustainable living and looking at alternatives.
I have a hope that God is using this moment and maybe some creative ways to revision the world.
In the Earthkeepers community, people are quite hungry to understand what they can actually do. People are looking for actionable steps to take. And so I'm wondering, what does Plant with Purpose represent in terms of possibilities for people making a difference?
The easiest and most obvious answer is to connect with us. Find us on social media, Plant with Purpose or Plant W Purpose. Check out our website, plantwithpurpose.org. Follow us. If you are in a spot, we are always looking for financial supporters who can build those relationships with global communities. That's a great way to make a difference. But the other thing that we recommend is talk to your church. We have found that churches are hungry for information right now and ways to talk about the environment. And we've been trying to connect with networks of churches that are interested in kind of reimagining the world in a more sustainable, environmentally friendly fashion. And
let me ask you also, many of our listeners to the Earthkeepers podcast actually wouldn't belong to a church or wouldn't necessarily even adhere to the Christian faith. And I'm wondering, what would you say then to people asking the same question, what can we do if they're involved in other types of faith communities?
I would say the same. That often a faith community, just by nature of the community aspect, is a great place to start. In a lot of the countries, there are other large faith communities. Thailand, for example, most of our partner families would be Buddhist, and often we're working with those faith communities there. In Tanzania, probably mostly in Tanzania, a lot of our partners are the Muslim faith communities there, we find that sometimes we can even start with talk about God's creation, since we do share a lot of those same stories and heritage in those two faith traditions. And that sometimes it's the mosques that are getting the church, they're getting the people together to plant trees and restore their community. So I would say the same. In general, faith communities are a fantastic way to gather a group of people around making these types of changes. And we very firmly believe that faith communities are the biggest way that we can change the way that we think about community, about environmentalism and about sustainability and about these climate issues that we're facing.
So do you think that's because, is it just the nature of communities and the potential to mobilize for earth care? Or is there something about having a spiritual perspective in general, something about that lends itself easily to caring for the earth?
My thought is we are all craving God, in that we're craving something that leads us to a lot of these answers and a lot of these questions and a lot of this seeking knowledge. And I'm hoping that we're finding hope and we're finding truth and we're finding something that is beautifully transformational. But I know that around the world, people are seeking and craving God, and that is often what is leading to transformation.
We've been talking with Christy Renaud, Director of Marketing and Development at Plant with Purpose. If you would like to know more about the work of Plant with Purpose or even contribute to it, you'll find helpful links and resources in this episode's notes section. Earthkeepers podcast explores ways in which we can change ourselves, our communities, and our cultures to help us to care for the earth in holistic and regenerative ways. Through curated conversations, we highlight the wisdom of thought leaders and change agents who are making a difference and showing us a way forward. When Earthkeepers stand together, they amplify the impact of their resistance against environmental injustice and multiply their efforts for renewal and restoration. We invite you to support us by becoming a subscriber. You can help us reach more people with our message by leaving a positive review on Apple Podcasts. And please, share Earthkeepers podcast with anyone you know who seeks a better relationship to the Earth. This podcast is an expression of Circlewood, an organization whose purpose it is to cultivate transformative communities that love and care for all creation. If you'd like to learn more about the Circlewood community, please visit our website at www.circlewood.online or write to us at podcast@circlewood.online. I'm Forrest Tinsley, your podcast host. Our executive producer is James Amidon. Forrest Reed is our sound engineer and the creator of our original music. Our research assistant is Rochelle Nordman. Thank you, friends, for listening. And please join us for our next conversation on the Earthkeepers podcast.